Today's speaker is Mara McDonald. Many of you probably know Mara as the administrative person for the Evolution Initiative on campus. But Mara received her BA from UCLA and a master's from Berkeley. She then did her PhD at the University of Florida, and following a Smithsonian postdoc, and I believe a postdoc in Missouri?
Not quite.
Okay.
It never panned out.
Came to UW-Madison. Today she's speaking about speciation and baby birds.
I might point out that each of those degrees is about 10 years apart, and I was actually thinking about going to law school in my fourth decade, but it was too expensive at that point. So what I'm going to be talking about today is basically my dissertation research that was done in the, I'm going to say 50s, but it was done in the 80s. And I feel kind of old. It was done in the 80s in Haiti, and the analysis was done at the Savannah River Ecology Lab, which, although it was supported by the Department of Energy at the time and was looking at the effects of nuclear pollution on 100,000 acres of a national plantation, it did support projects like mine. And I really like to know how they did that. The first thing I'm going to attack is, why is it the untanager instead of just tanagers? Since Christopher Columbus hit the shores of Hispaniola and explorers started sending back specimens of birds and other animals from the New World, Hispaniola and palm tanagers, which are very common, at least one of the species that is, have been recognized as belonging to the family, now the subfamily, of tanagers, which is this amazing neotropical radiation of very colorful birds. Since we've gotten new, since there have been developed new and cheaper molecular technologies, a new interest in molecular systematics of birds has arisen with a collaborative study across the U.S. called Early Bird. And one of the findings is that Darwin's finches are not, they're actually Caribbean tanagers. They're not finches, they're tanagers. Whereas Hispaniola and palm tanagers are not. Their roots go so far back, we have no idea where they belong. So what's to talk about if your study organism doesn't belong to the tree of life? That was a problem for me. It's like, wow, so many years, so much work. Well, I have an interest in conservation genetics, although I was never directly implicated in conservation genetics. And I want to propose that the model of the study organisms I'm going to be talking about would serve as an excellent model for John McDonald's hypothesis that founder effect speciation with a subsequent increase in mobile genetic elements in the genome in small founding populations could affect regulatory genes and lead to macroevolutionary events. Now, we know that founder effect speciation is probably not very common, and we know that given McDonald's suggestion, the likelihood of a macroevolutionary event may be very low. But if there's any validity to his model, then I think that we can learn from it and apply it to some of the small populations of animals that are on the brink of extinction. And I think that that's really important. And that's why I have been talking about this model for the last 20 years, other than just recycling the data and liking to talk about birds. So my my point here is that these birds may serve as a good study model to test some of the predictions from John McDonald's model. Now, I did submit an NSF postdoctoral grant about 20 years ago to do just that, and I was told that I needed preliminary data. Unfortunately, I was working at McDonald's selling hamburgers at the time, and none of the McDonald's in these in the story are related in any way, or I could have done the study. So why study speciation in birds? This is the outline that I'm going to go through today. In, we know that the radiation of birds is probably recent and happened very quickly, and there have been arguments about the species of birds that we recognize are probably subspecies, etc. But I think that that's been put to rest. I think that we know from morphological comparisons among vertebrates using morphological distances, having measured the same structures, that birds are recognized at the same level as other vertebrate species. Morphologically, therefore, we're recognizing species of birds. Genetically, they appear to be as diverse as other vertebrates. At least they fall within the range of heterozygosities. And this is based on protein electrophoresis. Some of you may not have even been a gleam in your father's eye when we were doing protein electrophoresis. So I'll talk about it in just a minute. What was interesting for me was that the average genetic distance among birds is an order of magnitude lower than for other vertebrate species.
What do you mean average genetic? You mean between every possible pair of bird species?
That were surveyed at that particular point.
Across all birds?
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are
mm-hmm.
ostriches or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Now, protein electrophoresis, as many of you know, indirectly measures changes in structural genes. And in the mid-1970s, Mary Claire King and Alan Wilson looked at differences between chimps and humans and found that chimps had a genome similarity of 95 to 98% with humans. And they explained the differences between chimps and humans as probably due to differences in regulatory genes. And so this was a very interesting hypothesis in the 70s. The low genetic distances for avian species that have been observed using protein electrophoresis, given that the taxa are recognized at the same levels as other vertebrates, could be due to regulatory gene evolution. And so that was the hypothesis or assumption that I was working under. Stephen Jay Gould suggested that rapid evolutionary changes could be achieved by changes in regulatory genes, which turn on and off structural or other regulatory genes. Small changes in early development could have major effect on the phenotype. Using traits already adapted to various environments in a descendant species could explain periods of rapid evolution. Now recall that this was about the time Gould's model for heteroprony came out in late 77, but he was looking for a mechanism for rapid evolutionary change after publishing the punctuated equilibria paper with Eldridge in the early part of the 70s. So what is Gould's model of heteroprony? Heteroprony is defined as shifts in developmental timing events. Paramorphosis is that part of heterochrony where you have an addition of a new stage, a new trait, Gesundheit, most likely due to mutations in protein-coding loci. Pedomorphosis, on the other hand, and that's what I'm going to be looking at today, is the retention of ancestral juvenile traits in a descendant species, and is likely due to regulatory gene changes. I won't be testing that hypothesis. I'm making the assumption it is. Examples of pedomorphisms are humans. Some of us resemble infant apes more than adult apes and are considered pedomorphic to them. We've retained juvenile features of our ape baby ancestors, including hairlessness and cute brown baby features. I thought that was a good picture, David. Juvenile features have evolved to decrease aggression towards the infant. In contrast, adult apes, which are hairier, have a large brow ridge and hairy muzzle, among other attributes, are different from baby apes, and many of their features are used in aggression and for sexual attraction. Oops, how do I go back? Pedomorphosis, or retention of juvenile traits, it also extends to behaviors. The Coppingers, Ray and Lorna Coppinger and others, have documented how dogs reflect arrested development of their wolf ancestors. Dogs that resemble wolf puppies retain the behaviors for that developmental stage in wolves and don't go beyond it. Other species, including sheep, have evolved by retaining various stages of pedomorphic behaviors with concomitant juvenile morphology of their ancestors. Now, this is a picture of a wolf with small beady eyes, pointed muzzle, pointed ears, and these are pictures of sweet little puppies with floppy ears, round eyes, big smiles on their face. And they are considered somewhat pedomorphic to the wolf ancestor. And one particular breed, or several breeds, like the golden retrievers, are really, really puppy-like in retaining juvenile features of the wolf ancestor. Piaget also observed that children went through developmental stages behaviorally and morphologically, and that these stages corresponded to each other. Delayed growth in a child resulted in a delay in the appearance of the next stage of behavior. So the point here is that morphology and behavior are tightly linked. Gould proposed that pedomorphosis, and this is his model, if you can get through his ontogeny and phylogeny book, is that pedomorphosis can be achieved in two ways, and these are a result of the environment and the resources available. Now, there are two traits that I will be looking at in this particular study of the palm tanagers, but I'm going to go through his model just to talk about it briefly. He proposed that neoteny was evolved in relation to case selection or limiting resources. Somatic maturation is delayed. First stage to reproduction is varied and is resource dependent. You can get a high variance around first stage to reproduction in neotenic species, and I'll talk about this in a minute. Resource abundance is limiting, but it could be cycling. Fecundity is low, and body size is larger than the antecedent species. In contrast, progenesis is in response to R selection, and juvenile morphology is arrested after early reproduction, so there is no development into an adult morphotype. First stage to reproduction is accelerated and should have a low variance around it. Resources are abundant, fecundity is high, and body size is relatively smaller to the antecedent species. some examples of neoteny occur in birds but weren't actually recognized as neoteny until about the mid-80s. Red-winged blackbirds have delayed plumage maturation, and Sievert Brouwer demonstrated that adult blackbirds do not attack birds in juvenile plumage. So this allows juveniles to get by and learn all kinds of things, and in periods of high resource abundance, they can breed without worrying about having to deal with adult males. Marcy and Robert Lawton demonstrated neoteny in brown jays in Costa Rica. Fran Hammerstrom didn't know that she was looking at neoteny, but she did some really nice work on harriers in Wisconsin. And subadult males, not in adult plumage, breed when resources are high. When there are plenty of foals, the subadult males will breed, and the adult males will be polygamous. When resources are low, when foal populations are low, subadults don't breed, and adults become monogamous. So there's a high variance in neotenic species with respect to first age to reproduction, and it's dependent on the cycling of resources. Mercedes Foster also noted neoteny in manakins in Peru. And I might point out that I think on page 300 something in Gould's book on ontogeny and phylogeny, he said heterochrony doesn't apply to birds. At the time I was doing my work on palm tanagers, Mercedes and Marcy were doing their work on neotenic species. And Marcy Lawton had the gumption to go to Gould and say, "You're wrong. We're seeing this in birds." And I think that it's probably very important to avian speciation to look at developmental timing events. Now, the hypotheses that I'm going to be putting out there, whether they're tested completely or not, are that the retention of juvenile features in the adult of a descendant species may be a faster means of evolving new species. This is what Gould was thinking. So it doesn't require long periods of selection to achieve an adaptive phenotype because the phenotype has been adapted. And it's dependent on developmental changes moderated most likely by regulatory genes. So now I'm going to be talking about the untanagers, how baby birds relate to speciation. There are two species of palm tanagers endemic to the island of Hispaniola, which is the second largest island in the West Indies next to Cuba. One species, the black-crowned palm tanager, is found throughout most of Hispaniola, and it's a very common and dominant species. The other species is the gray-crowned palm tanager, and it's basically limited to the southern peninsula of Haiti and the Île Lagunov just off Port-au-Prince. It's the only species of bird endemic only to Haiti. I once suggested it should become the national bird, and I was told, no, the guinea fowl was more relevant because it reminded Haitians of their connection to Africa. So a non-native bird is the national species. What I was able to do when I was there was document a hybrid zone between black crowns and gray-crowned palm tanagers. What I won't go into a lot of detail, but what we were able to demonstrate was that this hybrid zone was basically a hybrid sink, that there were few alleles that were able to go to flow to either side of the hybrid zone, and that based on morphological variance of the hybrids, which was very, very low, it appeared that there were no there was little to no back crossing of F1s. There. the black crown palm tanager, the one that's found on most of Hispaniola. There's an age dimorphism in morphology in this bird. The black, the adult bird has a black crown. It has sort of a gray-green back. It has some gray on the side, some white under the chin, and the white it sort of diffuses through the breast. It's also age dimorphic. Juvenile black crowns have gray crowns. And because of this, I'll go to the next slide before I say anything. So what we have are this species that's found throughout most of Hispaniola. And then the second species is the gray crown palm tanager, Phenacophthalus polyacephalus. And it's retained the gray crowns of the juvenile black crown palm tanager. And because of this, it's often been confused with juveniles, or juveniles have been confused with this. The distribution of gray crown palm tanagers was not really clear until I started my work, because what people didn't recognize was that there was a unique character evolved in gray crown palm tanagers, such that they have a white chin with a gray throat, a gray throat pattern. In foraging behavior, there are differences. Black crown palm tanagers are age dimorphic in feeding behaviors. Juveniles feed mostly on stationary food, like berries, and adults seem to be more insectivorous. And gray crowns have retained the feeding behavior of juvenile black crowns. This is not the best slide to show that. This is foraging behavior in pine forest, broadleaf, and shrub habitat. There are differences, and this is foliage gleaning, forgivery, hover gleaning, and other behaviors. And this is the adult black crown, the juvenile black crown, and the gray crown palm tanagers. And it basically shows that there are differences among habitat types and among the three groups that I'm looking at. Statistically, in 8 foraging variables that I looked at, black crown palm tanagers were significantly different from juveniles of their own species in 5 of those variables. That included activity, speed, duration of stop, percent time spent stop, and food catching per purse change. Black crown palm tanager adults also differed significantly from gray crown palm tanagers in 4 of those variables: activity, speed, duration of stop, and food catching attempts per perch change. In none of the 8 variables did juvenile black crowns differ from gray crown palm tanagers with any significance. Yes, the speed of light. This is a really old slide, but I think that it shows some things I want to talk about. These are 3 different foraging variables: food catching attempts per minute, food catching attempts per perch change, and activity. And this is gray crown, this is for September, and this is for October of 1984. The top line is the mean and standard area for error for gray crown palm tanagers. The second line is the same for black crowned adults. And the third line is for black crowned juveniles. And I think as you go down and across, you can see that juvenile black crowns tend to be more like gray crown palm tanagers in these 3 variables than they are to adults of their own species. And that's a little blurry, but that basically states that juveniles and gray crown palm tanagers are more alike than adults of the black crown palm tanagers. Now, we know from Rauer's work on red-winged blackbirds and actually other examples that juvenile traits have likely evolved to deflect aggression from adults. The prediction that Marcy and Robert Lawton made from this observation is that pedomorphic species retaining juvenile characters, juvenile morphologies, will be more social and found together in flocks, more so than their non-pedomorphic counterparts or their... I won't go on with that. What I found is that gray-crowned palm tanagers were found in groups of more than two individuals in the non-breeding season significantly more often than black-crowned palm tanagers. Whereas I would see black-crowned palm tanagers as single or in pairs, single individuals or in pairs. With the gray-crowned palm tanagers, I often saw them in groups of 4 to 6 individuals, suggesting that they were flocking because they had retained, possibly due to the fact that they had retained juvenile morphology and agonistic signals had been reduced. And I tested this for the non-breeding season because in the breeding season you expect family groups in both species. Now, Gould's heterochrony model makes predictions about morphology and body size of the pedomorphic species. If you recall, he divided neoteny and progenetic species. Neotenic species are expected to be larger because there's delayed somatic maturation. They have a longer period to grow, whereas progenetic species are expected to be smaller than their sister species. And progenetic species are expected to evolve in our selected environments where resources are plentiful, then birds can breed early. Reproduction often leads to arrested development in body size. And thus, progenetically derived species should be smaller than the antecedent species. Gray-crowned palm tanagers are significantly smaller than black-crowned palm tanagers in several body size measures, including bill length, toe length, wing cord, brain case length, and proximal bill and depth measures. I don't know why pushing the little red button doesn't change. So this is basically a Mann-Whitney U test of several body size measures. And the first column is whether there's a significant difference between adult black crowns and juveniles of the same species, whether there's a significant difference in body size variables for the juvenile black crowns and the gray crown palm tanagers, and whether there's a significant difference between adult black-crowned palm tanagers and gray-crowned palm tanagers. For the adult to juvenile comparison, there were significant differences for three of the variables, wing cord, brain case, and a bill measurement. For differences between juvenile black-crowns and gray-crowns, again, there were three significant differences. Two of them for bill measures and one for the middle toe. But for adults being compared to gray crown palm tanagers, all the variables were significantly different. So adults are significantly, or gray crown palm tanagers are smaller than black crown palm tanagers in 3 to 7 variables. Now, one of the things that Gould's model doesn't take into account is what to expect in terms of genetics, in terms of genetic heterozygosity in this case, which we were really hot on in Mike Smith's lab at the Savannah River Ecology Lab. We found that black crown adults and juveniles were significantly different in heterozygosity. But what was really surprising is that juveniles were almost twice as heterozygous as the adults of their own species, and this was highly significant. Whereas gray crown palm tanagers, in terms of heterozygosity, fell between the two age classes and black crowns in terms of heterozygosity, they were not significantly different from either age class. And I might point out that these data have all been, well, almost all of them have been corrected for multiple comparisons. So when we find differences at this level, we corrected it for the multiple comparison here.
Does this mean that the same population changed standards of custody and going from juvenile to adult? How can that happen?
Well, that's a good question. I'm about ready to throw out a speculation. You may want to leave for this one, Jim, because it's speculative. But
and the data are not speculative.
These data are not speculative. And there has been at least one other paper around this time in toadlets where the young toads were more heterozygous than the adults. And I'm going to go into a speculation.
Is there a lot of differential mortality, for example?
I don't know. I wasn't there long enough to really to get enough data on that. I mean, one of the things is that there's a lot that has to be done on this system alone or a system like this. You don't dare go into Haiti these days, you know, without fear of getting killed or kidnapped. So you'd have to find a similar system. Now, one of the questions that I asked is, did a single locus contribute to the age dimorphism? And this table looks at 13 loci where there are differences in heterozygosity between the adults and the juveniles, where the juveniles are more heterozygous than the adults. And what I did was I did a jackknife, by definition, David, an old jackknife procedure, and I removed one locus at a time, recalculated the heterozygosity for the two age classes, and then tested for their significance. And for these 13 loci, I found no single locus contributing to the age differences in heterozygosity. So it wasn't a one or two locus effect. It looks like it was across the range of loci, or a range of loci. So the problem, as you raised, Jim, is how do you get heterozygous kids if you're mostly homozygous? And this is where it's going to get speculative because I didn't have time to really think this through.
Let me ask one more question. Are these differences measured within a generation or between generations?
It's within. So that was another thing is that I collected just 1 year. So I have juveniles and adults from 1 year's worth of collections. And the reason that was the case was that I was required, it took me forever to get a shotgun into Haiti, and I was required to get ammunition from the Haitian army, and they ran out. So my sample sizes are small, 20 to 22 individuals per species. And I could only collect, I only had data from that 1 year of collecting. And I think that, you know, the questions you're asking are really important. I'm sorry, Jenny.
That's okay. So is there any chance that parents are mating sort of disassortedly?
I'm sorry.
Is there any chance that the parents are mating disassortatively so that a homozygous big A makes more likely
right.
a homozygous little A? Or?
I don't know. I didn't find sexual or morphologically differences due to sex. I found differences due to age. And I'm not sure. What this was basically a survey. I traveled throughout Haiti collecting information on, I did transects at numerous places, and I collected variables on the nesting site locations and other things. And so, and when I started collecting birds, it was also a survey across Haiti. But there wasn't any opportunity to sit in one place and observe what goes on behaviorally. And that's what needs to be done here.
I'm afraid I still don't understand this. You said that the adults and juveniles are the same generation. And yet your question up here says, how can you get heterozygous kids if you're most
healthy? Well, I'm sorry, Jim. I meant that they were collected in the same year.
So they're different generations.
Yeah, they're different generations, yeah. I'm sorry. Yes.
But the allele frequencies aren't the same in adults and in young.
The allele frequencies are different. I mean, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Found
differences in allele frequencies.
So the question that Jim asked and the question that we asked is how do you get heterozygous young? And totally the same pattern was seen at one point in Bufo totalits. Now recall that protein electrophoresis indirectly measures differences in proteins based on the size and conformation of the proteins in a particular buffer. And some differences, and then you indirectly suggest something about the genetics of the group. It's not a direct measurement. And some differences are not easily detectable with protein electrophoresis. You could see the same band at the same location, and they could actually be different genes. Now, this is the highly speculative part of the talk, but I was looking several months ago at those loci where the juveniles were more heterozygous than the adults, and there were six of them. And I went back and I looked at whether they were heterodimeric and whether they were age dimorphic, similar to the hemoglobin protein in mammals. And if you recall, hemoglobin is a tetramer composed of two chains, an alpha and a gamma, I think it's a gamma, in the fetus. And as the individual ages, that second chain is replaced by a beta hemoglobin. So the question is, are you actually measuring the same things in adults and juveniles? Or are you measuring slightly different proteins? And that's something that I don't know. If what we observe occurs across years, such that juveniles are often more heterozygous than adults, and if a number of other assumptions are met, it's possible that adults are expressing less heterozygous loci than the juveniles. It turns out that there was a study done by Tesca et al. At Savannah River Ecology Lab to test whether heterozygosity had any kind of fitness component to it. And they used paramiscus mice, and they measured everything that went into the paramiscus and everything that came out. So they were looking at how they used their food resources. Under normal quality food, there were no differences between heterozygous individuals and homozygous individuals, they were equally efficient at food use. When they decreased the quality of the food, there was a substantial difference. Heterozygous individuals became more efficient at processing the food. So under stress levels, there seems to be, under certain conditions, an advantage to being heterozygous. And I can attest that the juveniles are not efficient foragers. I've watched them feeding. There's one anecdote where I watched a baby or a young bird sitting in a bush watching a gnat swarm go around its head, and it watched it and watched it and watched it, and I expected it to dart out and try to catch a gnat. Instead, it fell out of the bush. And I've seen other situations similar to that with these young birds. So they are not efficient foragers. So that's my major speculation, Jim. The synopsis so far is that black-crowned palm tanagers are age dimorphic, morphologically, behaviorally, and genetically, and that gray-crowned palm tanagers resemble the juveniles of the black crown morphologically, behaviorally, and, as we're going to suggest, can be derived from them genetically. And this is where I get into the colonization model. Jim, do you recognize this?
No.
Oh, that's too bad, because it's found in Crow and Kimura. And it's the expected heterozygosity after founding. So this is your expected heterozygosity. This is the size of the founder population. And this is the observed heterozygosity of the current population. And Baker and Moeed use this to look at founding population sizes, or to estimate founding population sizes in minas across Asia and Australia. And based on that, I used it to estimate what the founders could be, what the founding populations would be composed of, and what the size of the founding population might be. Now, the assumption for this particular model is that there's no selection. And I just argued that we've got selection in our species. And what I'm going to do is ignore that and propose that Jim Crow could never give a model like this without it being terribly robust.
Well, that would be a lot clearer if you put it in parentheses.
I'm sorry?
Go back to the last slide.
Okay. Well, there it is.
Clear. If you put parentheses, putting the 2 and the n naught together, because this is really 1 over 2 n naught rather than 1 half n naught.
Okay.
No wonder.
I took it from the Baker and Moeed article, so I need to go back and look at that. Okay. Well, then this may not be Jim's model. What we did was we did a simulation looking at expected heterozygosity in founders over varying founding population sizes. This is the level of heterozygosity observed in gray-crowned palm tanagers at the point of collection. If you start out with a founding population composed of all adult black crowns, you get nowhere near this level of heterozygosity in gray-crowned palm tanagers. If you assume that the founding populations are composed all of juveniles, you exceed that level early on, and founding populations are 4 to 6 individuals. If you assume a mix of founders, of adults and juveniles, you get within 2 standard errors. So we propose that the founding populations for gray-crowned palm tanagers were probably composed mostly of juveniles, maybe of some adults. And there are some observations in neotenic brown jays where flocks moving into new habitat are composed mostly of juvenile individuals. Now, during the Pleistocene and Pliocene, glaciers melted and sea levels rose, and Hispaniola was cut in at least two different islands across the cul-de-sac plain, so that this was the Big Island and this was the South Island, and across a small valley called the Twin Valley. And it's much smaller. You can see from one edge to the other easily. It's not very wide. And there are James Bond, not the 007 figure, but the ornithologist from which Ian Fleming stole the name, hypothesized that the Twin Valley was where the two palm tanagers were separated during the flooding of the valley. I hypothesized that it was across the cul-de-sac plain because it was much wider, and that these birds fly around. They're good flyers, and they could fly across the Twin Valley without much problem. So we have geological evidence that during the appropriate times of estimated divergence, which is based on protein electrophoresis from our data 50,000 to 260,000 years ago, are based on a recent paper of 2.5 million years ago that the palm tanagers diverged, that the great crown palm tanager is found on the South Island, and we've argued that it's not a vicarious event, that it was probably the founder event. So our model is that small founding populations composed mostly of juveniles probably colonized the South Island. Without competition and with abundant resources, juveniles were able to breed successfully. And because reproduction is energetically costly, their growth, their somatic growth, stopped. The genetic data support the model that derived populations could have fixed development in the juvenile stage. The great crown palm tanagers retained their gray crowns and evolved unique white chin character with a gray throat. They also retained other juvenile features of black crown antecedents. And we propose that when Hispaniola rejoined, populations had differentiated enough to reduce gene flow when they hybridize. Okay. There. For those of you still awake, neotenies express behaviorally and morphologically in black crown palm tanagers, and it's congruent with the H dimorphism in heterozygosity. Derivation of gray crowns from small founding populations composed mostly of juvenile black crowns is consistent with high juvenile heterozygosity, likely dispersal by juveniles in birds, and resultant high heterozygosity in gray crown palm tanagers. And I might point out that the level of 10% heterozygosity in gray crown palm tanagers was really high, relatively high for birds that had been surveyed up until the point of this research. Gould's model of heterochrony explains rapid evolutionary change. We've shown that gray crown palm tanagers have retained several of the juvenile features of the black crown palm tanager antecedent. And we've proposed that small founding populations are composed of juveniles colonized the South Island. And divergence times, whether you use the protein electrophoretic divergence or the little longer divergence time based on mitochondrial DNA, correspond to geological events in the Caribbean. What we need to do if me, myself, and I could have continued this work is to look at whether speciation is more rapid when life history traits are variable. That from this we've concluded that colonizers, speciation for neotenic species expanding into new environments can occur if colonizers are highly variable genetically. If they have a high reproductive rate and low mortality at low densities when they're just getting started, if the founding populations are small, and if reproductive isolation occurs shortly after founding. Now, the problem is that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to support these species as a model in terms of what we were, what I've just presented to you. But there's also a lot of information and future work that could be done. First of all, as I mentioned, the genetic data are just taken from 1 year of collecting. We need to evaluate whether the first stage to reproduction is early in great crown palm tanagers. That takes much longer field time. We need to evaluate the hypothesis I threw out that age dimorphic heterozygosity is due to age dimorphic changes in proteins. We need to establish whether other neotenic systems are dimorphic in the same way in other species. And there are lots of species, bird species out there where this can be tested. The eastern and western tanagers are a good case. They're in the genus Piranga. They're no longer tanagers either, but they have a big distribution throughout Central and South America, and you see, if you look at the western tanager, it has a red head and a yellow body, and it resembles the juvenile scarlet tanager on the East Coast. So it appears that what's going on in Piranga may be this sort of pedomorphic speciation. It might be worthwhile looking at. We also need to find similar examples where pedomorphic sister taxa, we need to look for pedomorphic sister taxa for patterns of founding via pedomorphosis. And what's really, you know, what I've been trying to drum into someone is that we need to test John McDonald's model using the system or another system, just to see if there's anything there that might help with keeping some species from going to extinction by understanding how founding populations may be formed if they are, and understanding the genetics behind them. I'd like to thank a number of people, Michael Smith. This is how old I am. All of my committee members are retired. Mike Smith did a whole lot in terms of supporting my analysis at the Savannah River Ecology Lab. Lincoln Brower, Carmen Lanciani, and Larry Harris were really very supportive of me. Jim Novak was not only a statistical advisor, but taught me how to play racquetball. Bob Zink was the LSU curator of frozen tissues where I deposited my specimens. He's now at the Bell Museum in Minnesota. James Bond, whose name was considered manly by Ian Fleming and thus taken for his 007 character, did help a great deal in because he had done the original bird surveys in the Caribbean. He gave me a lot of advice. Storrs Olson and Mercedes Foster, the National Museum, the Lawtons, Robert Casagnol, who was in the government of Haiti and very important in my being able to get around, and David Wake, who is a really marvelous person who has done pedomorphosis in salamanders, gave a lecture in an evolution class on Gould's heteroprony model, and that really caught my attention. So I do have a lot of acknowledgments, and then I have a lot of people to thank for giving me bits of support during my graduate training and currently. Thank you. Yes?
I was just curious, with the age dimorphism and heterozygosity, you said it was also found in toadlets?
In toadlets, yeah.
What was the explanation for that?
That they were going through, it's been a long time since I read that, but I think that they were going through a particularly difficult time. They were under stress, and I think it was a drought that may have pushed it.
So the stress-driving expression.
Mm-hmm.
Thank Mara again.
Okay, thank you.